Welcome, Fan Lebitardians, to the 20th episode of the Fan Lebitard Show. With your help, this podcast has grown by leaps and bounds over these past four, almost 5 months now. Absolutely crazy. Please continue to like, subscribe, rate, and review the show. Follow us on Twitter at lebitard_fan and continue to help us spread the word because I feel like this show has some momentum right now. On this very special episode, we welcome in our first member of the shipping container, Chris Whittingham. We talk show, we talk soccer. It's about what you probably expected, to be honest, but it's still a really fun conversation, and I guarantee you will walk away from it having learned something. But before we get into the interview, it feels very fitting that today, on a milestone episode for this podcast, the Dan Lebitard Show has hit a milestone of its own. On Tuesday, Scoops Cody dropped the news we've all been waiting for, the landing spot for the pirate ship. And that answer is DraftKings. Now, I was very confused by this news because I had not personally thought them to be in the race for the show. But after reading the details, which I will not give you here because I want to direct you to Greg Cody's column in the Miami Herald, it just reinforces to me how much Dan and Stu care about this audience. They turned down more money so we, the loyal listeners, wouldn't potentially be locked out behind a paywall or subscription. Class acts, truly. This podcast's first episode wondered aloud what the future of the Dan Lebitard Show might be. And here on episode 20, we finally have our answer. So from the bottom of my heart, congratulations to everybody involved in the show because they just got paid in a big way. It's a dangerous game to bet on yourself on a scale as large as theirs, but it quite literally paid off. And I know I'm not alone in saying that I look forward to seeing how the show develops with the backing of DraftKings. One final note before we get into the interview. I want to give a huge shout out to our guest from episode 19, Christina Buswell. She not only was a fantastic guest on this podcast, but she then went on to the podcast that she produces, Sports with Katie Nolan, and gave this podcast coverage on an ESPN platform. So, now that Katie Nolan and Travis know that this podcast exists, I am extending an open invitation for them to join me as guests at any time. Just throwing it out there. But Christina, if you hear this, you are a rock star, and thank you so much for giving the show some love. Now, if you'll all excuse me, I'm going to transfer all my winnings from FanDuel and into DraftKings. Enjoy the interview with Witty, and I'll talk to you all next week. This is the Fan Lebitard Show. Ladies and gentlemen, I am so excited to bring you this episode today because we finally landed our first whale. We have a member of the shipping container. No, I'm not talking about Dan Lebitard, not a literal whale, but we've got a whale. Ladies and gentlemen, I am pleased to welcome in Chris Whittingham, I think it's safe to say the most intellectually stimulating member of the shipping container at this point. Chris, are you comfortable with that?
No, I'd go for Chris Cody for that one.
We'll talk about him later. So this first question that I'm going to ask you is normally a formality at the start of any of these interviews, but after the absolutely harrowing bomb threat that you encountered today at the Clevelander, I ask you sincerely, Chris Whittingham, you good?
I'm good. You good?
I'm good. So
I feel like laughter was perhaps the wrong reaction to a bomb threat. I don't know why. I didn't feel any sense of danger pulling into the garage, which is directly attached to a building, under a bomb threat. We were more concerned with getting back into the building than, you know, the threat of a bomb. I guess you're just kind of, instinctually mistrustful might be the wrong word, but just like, oh, come on, like, someone called this in, was playing a prank, it wasn't funny, and all that. But yeah, I mean, we weren't terribly bothered about it, and we were able to get back in, and thankfully everything was okay.
Sports Illustrated was not taking Jessica's first day very well, were they?
Wow, I don't like the accusation here. I'm not drifting to conspiracy here.
Reckless speculation alert. We'll put that sounder in there.
You're good. So,
So today was a revealing day for a lot of reasons, not the least of which was your revelation that you're using your stove as your alarm clock. And I want to give you the opportunity, I think, to explain yourself, because correct me if I'm wrong, you're a young professional, single, living in, I believe you said, a studio apartment. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Studio apartment in South Florida. And I have owned various alarm clocks. I've used my phone as an alarm clock. And in the end, I was kind of looking for some innovation. And in searching for innovation, I went backwards because I'm terrible at waking up. I'm terrible at early rising. And I believe I started this. I was calling. I was doing a tournament for CONCACAF, the CONCACAF Under 15s, and every morning. The first game is at 8 a.m., which means I had to be at the studio at like 6:30 to be ready for the game, which means you know, up at 5:30, 5:45, and I was struggling during this tournament. And the phone alarm, I kept fearing the snooze. I'm a snoozer. That 9-minute window is dangerous because who knows how deeply you can fall asleep in that 9-minute window.
Dangerous
game.
What
happens if you hit stop instead of snooze?
Oh, yep. That's
a dangerous game. So I decided I needed to figure something else out. I have an alarm clock, as I mentioned, which was recommended by, I think, Kinja Deals. That was like, it's an alarm clock that also kind of acts as like a big bright light that's meant to simulate the sun.
Okay.
That, for whatever reason, didn't do it for me. So I was like, what can I turn to? And I turned to the stove. And it worked brilliantly. And I get up in the morning, you know, a little bit panicked because it's a very loud noise. I feel like I might be annoying my neighbors, but I don't care. And it was a piercing enough sound, there's enough light involved, that once I've experienced it, I feel like I'm awake and I'm good. So for me, it is the best way to wake up.
So, okay, I think you would define it as efficient, but I think the rest of us would look at that and be like, that's a little strange. You acknowledge that, yes?
Not necessarily. Like, I mean, you wake up how you want to wake up. The only bit of it that I feel strange about is at night. It's like 9:37. And I want to get up the next morning at 6, and I have to do the math. All right, 6 hours plus 2 plus 23, 8 hours, 23. Like, I have to like, do the math in my head of how of what to set the timer for so that the alarm will go off at the time. That's the only bit where I go, this is odd. But other than that, I don't really see – I'm not wedded to convention, Ty. I'm someone who I'm willing to innovate. I'm willing to do – things different than other people and not think it to be weird. It's just, it's the way that I wake up.
That's why you're on this podcast, because you're an innovator, Chris Whittingham. I want to go to show related things now, because it has been said that to be on the Levitard show, you have to take aspects of your personality and then crank that volume up for entertainment purposes. And so I want to ask this very plainly. How much of the, and I'm using air quotes here, rivalry that exists between you and Chris Cody is performative?
I don't know if I want to break down the fourth wall here.
What is the fan Chris podcast for if not to break down the fourth wall?
I mean,
Whitty?
I don't want to reveal our secrets. No, I mean, Chris and I get along swimmingly. We have a great time. Our working relationship, really, as an entire shipping container, is tremendous. And I will say, like, there are probably bits of me that everyone finds annoying, right? When I was blabbering on about how I pronounce last names and I was doing Le Bâtard with a French accent, that probably is deeply annoying to a lot of people. So I completely understand why Chris would on air get annoyed, because he probably in his head is annoyed. Billy gets annoyed. He does, oh, enough. He does that to me a lot. And it's probably true, because when I'm in meetings, I do things like this all the time. I believe I relayed an anecdote on the air the other day in which we were in a meeting. I said, oh, yeah, you know, I was talking with the engineers and everything is copacetic. And I got, like, private messages like, oh, for the love of God, man. Like, even in meetings you're doing this? Like, no, this is just who I am. Like, I use annoying language all the time. It's just whatever the word that pops in my head is the word that I will use. So, in my view, I'm just being me. Well, I'm not going to have a go at Chris for saying, I mean, everyone does a pile on whenever someone screws up, but I'm not going to, like, I don't want to belittle anyone for making mistakes. So, like, there's only so far that I will go in making fun of him. But yeah, I mean, the rest of the guys find me annoying sometimes. It's totally fine because ultimately it's an expression of who I am.
Well, we're going to use your intelligence here. No pressure. This was off the cuff. Had not planned this out before, but Chris Whittingham, can you give us a word of the day?
That is a great question. I was really amused at something. My favorite word of the day was something that you heard on the Dan Le Batard show, which was Adnan Verk describing a movie as wretched. And Chris was actually like alarmed at the number of sounds that I was making. I was just going, oh, like it was like bordering on sensual. The reactions that I had to the word wretched. I don't know why. Just because it was like, you can describe something as bad, or you can describe it as wretched. Like, wretched is a different level. So, for that day, I will say, I have a note somewhere on my phone, and you can go ahead and keep talking so that I can find it. We had John Skipper on for the Southbeat sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, so I wrote these down. So, He was on one in terms of words, and it was another situation where I was in the room with Mike Ryan, and I just kept going, oh, like I was making like these noises, right, that are alarming probably now to your listeners that have AirPods on. But here are the words that I wrote down to because I was so impressed with them that I wanted to incorporate them into my everyday language. Michigas, tremendous word.
What the hell does that even mean?
Which I believe is like it's like frivolity, like it's kind of like it might be like mischief or fun. Yeah, craziness, senseless behavior or activity. So it's actually a Yiddish word. So I love the word Michigas. I wanted to incorporate that into my daily life. He also said, "I am not very lubricious in social settings," which I believe means outgoing. Lubricious, tremendous word. The word sobriquet, tremendous. It's another word for a nickname. So, for example, John Wiener goes by the sobriquet Stu Gatz. Love that. Absolutely love that. I also used it the other day. Was it a mystery crate or was it a meeting? I don't remember. I used the phrase nom de plume. Tremendous, which is like a pen name for an author. Love that. Inui, tremendous word. It is another word for like your environment, like your surrounds. I wrote that down, and I have no idea why this is in here. Fufara. I don't know what that means.
What?
I wrote it down at some point, but I'm gonna Google it now. Fufara. So I for value for money, I gave you 5. Fufara, by the way, is a great deal of fuss or attention given to a minor matter. I don't know why I wrote that down or what context I heard it, but it must have struck me in some way because it's in my Apple Notes.
I need to compose myself for a second because
you just got an avalanche of nonsense.
What just happened there pushed me all the way back to being 16 with my mom shoving SAT in a box at me saying, "Learn these words, damn it. It's going to help you."
By the way, this defect of my personality is born out of that. It is born out of the SAT. It was not my mom, but it was a tutor. I had a tutor for the SAT, and literally with like a week to go, my tutor was like, "You're good. You're going to do fine on this test, but let's just see how many words we can cram." So there was this vocabulary cartoons in which you like there were it's like a book of words, but they were animated so that you can kind of like picture in your head what that word is, and maybe you pick off some of them. And we do like 250 a day, like one after the other. And maybe at the end I remembered 18 of them. But if one of them popped up on the SAT, then hell, it was worth it to learn. And I guess I never kind of got out of that mode of like noticing words and noticing language. And then the other aspect of this as well was I was studying for like play-by-play broadcasting. I had like a gap period in between gigs, and I watched like all these goals, right, from like the Premier League, from Europe and all this stuff, and I was studying the language that they use because I found when I was doing broadcasting that I kept using the same words to describe things. So I was like, what's every way to describe a cross? And when you listen to English commentators, like, they take the language out for a spin. Like, they will all the time use words where I'm like, damn, you said on a sports broadcast? That's incredible. So, it's kind of like, it's those two things, like always looking for the best way and most unique way to describe something. And now my brain is broken.
So, I feel the need to share this with you. Back when I was on the come up, fresh out of college, trying to get on the radio broadcasting, play-by-play grind, whatever you want to call it, I did some stuff where I was calling play-by-play and doing commentary for local high school soccer. And I found myself instinctively reverting into my worst instincts and just taking all the cues that I have heard from FIFA. And I just started essentially trying to speak like a British person. Absolute cracker of a goal, that it's just the most ridiculous shit.
Listen, I have done that as well. Sliding intervention I used the other day on a broadcast. You don't use that word. I would never use that phrase in a normal bit of context, but listen, I was doing a football match, so I had to, mate. You know what I mean?
Like, oh, that's that's a great accent.
Well, okay. Well, it's a subject of controversy, but anyway.
No. Let's go into it.
So definitely, like, British colloquialisms have worked their way into my commentary and otherwise. Yeah, that's a cracking goal. What a finish that! I've always wanted to shout that during a game, but I feel like I would get shouted down, and that's probably not the most professional thing to do.
That was spot on. Those were both incredible. What is controversial about that?
I annoy people with it. it was funny because I started on the show as an intern, like back like a decade ago, and we'd watch Champions League football while we were doing the show, because obviously Mike, massive Chelsea fan. This is 2012, around the time I was in college, and then Chelsea are going on that run to the Champions League final. And so, like, I would just be in the room, and I would start doing the accent, and Roy would just get incensed, like, stop it now. And I think, like, I think everyone in that room at the time found me annoying for doing that. And they still find me annoying for doing that. Some people find it funny. I have found that more people, particularly the people I professionally respect, mostly find it annoying.
I'm noticing a trend in your life here.
When people find me annoying?
Yeah, you know, I want to know, like, you had talked about your experience on, like, dating apps and stuff like that previously, yeah. And I'm curious if that is your opener. Like, hey, just as a heads up, everyone in my annoying. Life finds me annoying. Just what the success rate is on that.
I usually don't get to the stage on dating apps where I can. I need to look better with my shirt off in order to get to that stage. But yeah, I don't think I'm annoying. I just think that, like, I pursue, like, kind of my interest to its logical conclusion, right? So, like, I can't just become a fan of soccer. I have to, like, watch every Premier League match and do an impersonation of the commentator. So I think there's, like, almost like a like an obsessiveness, not an OCD, I think it's probably a bit too much, but just like I am like super passionate about my hobbies and about, like, all right, I can't just get into learning words, I have to learn all of them. Like, I'm kind of like an all-encompassing person that way, where, like, no matter what I do, I want to, like, learn all there is to know about it. And that kind of interest pursuing, or that kind of, like, caring about something, it can probably be annoying to other people. There are other times where I do it on purpose. Like, there are, like, I have friends where I'm annoying to them on purpose.
I'm going to move on, but I can't leave without this image popping into my head. The visual image of one of your Tinder matches spending the night and then waking up to you frantically running over to your stove the next morning to shut off your alarm and just watching the absolute bewilderment on their face. Like, what are you doing?
Bewilderment.
Ah, there
Excellent
we go.
Word. Love bewilderment.
All right, so we went into reckless speculation a little bit earlier, but I want to actually dive into it right now because I have a theory and I want you to help confirm or deny this. So as we heard today, we're recording on a Monday, Jessica just joined the shipping container, so it has now grown a little bit. And I gotta be honest, it has me wondering about your future specifically, because I have seen you everywhere. You've been doing play-by-play, it seems like you're getting in with Inter Miami, like, you're doing a lot of stuff on the side. You are very much on that young broadcaster grind right now. And so, with the shipping container getting crowded, I'm just a little bit curious, like, what is your plan as it pertains to the show moving forward, especially as it's in its pirate ship phase and, you know, about to, move forward with this big Meadowlark venture?
So my plan for the moment is to just enjoy everything, right? I love doing play-by-play. I've said to everyone involved that play-by-play is my passion. And so, you know, I'm going to take as many of these assignments as possible. Who knows if something comes of it. But also, like, on a kind of concurrent path is I love this show. Like, I don't know if I'd be, like, bold enough to do, a fan podcast about it, but I probably could. I mean, I've been listening to this show since I was in high school, right? It was my introduction to sports media. I was way too young to be listening to AM radio, but it didn't feel like AM radio to me. And so I love this show. And the idea that I get to go to work, air quotes work, and laugh like an idiot for 4 hours and maybe, like, do a bit of editing on, like, along with it, is like the greatest professional honor, blessing, ridiculous bit of luck that I've ever encountered. So I will, like, in some ways I don't ever want to, not that they'll have me for as long as I want to be there, but for as long as they'll have me, I will do as much as I can. Now, I probably am doing too much at the moment between the show. You mentioned kind of the pirate phase elements. Like, there is so much that goes beyond the show. That we're all working on. Like, it is an extraordinary amount of work for the number of people that we are. And so, you know, like, for example, you know, I do a lot of stuff with sales and making sure that all the commercials run on time. I know I'm not supposed to check the Reddit, but I check the Reddit just in case I've screwed anything up.
You poor bastard.
Like with editing and with, like, there's just so much going on, and we are all maximizing our output. We're doing as much as we possibly can. And that includes me. Like, I'm trying to do as much as I can. And ultimately, like, all I've said to Dan and to, you know, the executive team at Meadowlark is, whatever you guys will have me do, I'm happy to do it. Whether it's helping here, helping there, being a part of the show, not being a part of the show. So I'm having an immense amount of fun. And thankfully, you know, the show itself is in the morning and in the afternoon, and games are at nights and on the weekends. So I can do both. The question is that I'm stretching myself unbelievably thin, so I have to figure out the best way to manage my time and try and have a personal life. I guess the good news is that in a pandemic, there isn't really much personal life to be had, but yeah, I probably do need to achieve a greater work-life balance, but for the moment, I'm just having too much fun, and I have to, like, and I remind myself every day as I'm going in, today's a day to have fun, because this is an unbelievably... You know, if you had said to me that I would have been doing this when I was an intern or when I was listening to the show in high school, I'd have, like, absolutely thought you were insane. So, yeah, I'm loving the hell out of it, and I'll keep doing it as long as they'll have me.
The average listener is going to hear that as, like, oh, that's really great that Whittingham is having so much fun, and oh, it sounds so fun to work there. Me, as someone who's worked in radio before, I hear that, and I'm like, my God, they have Witty doing sales and traffic on the side. That is brutal.
Yeah, yeah, no, and you know, Roy and I are working on it together, and look, Stu Gatz is our lead salesman, like, and...
That's not a bit, he is actually heading that department.
He is leading our sales, and him and Bimal Kapadia, who's been announced as part of our executive team, it's their show, so, you know, and I, you know, Roy and I are tasked with executing it. It's a lot, man. It's like, it's a lot of business. It's a lot of, you know, assigning spots to where they're supposed to be, updating them. Like, I took some crap today because, you know, we ran the DraftKings spot from last week instead of today's, and I had to, like, you know, scramble home and edit and make sure that the right one was in. So, yeah, I mean, it's a lot of kind of that admin work that we all have to share, right? I mean, and every, like, you know, Billy is in guest booking now, and, like, he's killing it with guest booking right now. You know, Chris is such an instrumental part of, you know, putting content to, like, you know, our prep together and sound together and all that stuff. Like, everyone is carrying a fairly sizable, you know, amount of work right now. So, yeah, I mean, you know, and I understand it, so I'm happy to do it. But yeah, it's just a lot.
Now, see, that's the behind the scenes stuff that I want right there. That's the good stuff, Witty. I like that. But we're getting away from that because I want to get your thoughts on some Super League talk, because Ooh. The people have not had enough of that already. So it has been about a week since the Super League landed on our collective doorsteps, and it kind of, it absolutely rocked the sporting world for 48 hours until it folded, I guess you could say. Now that the dust has settled a little bit on that, do you think we have any sort of picture of what the lasting legacy of this failed experiment is going to be?
The lasting legacy of this will be almost its own identity, right? So, like, the Super League, if it's ever brought up again, we will remember last week. We will remember the moment in time in which we thought it was going to happen. Everyone railed against it, and then all the major, or most of the major clubs, backed away from it. And we will remember how deeply unpopular it was. So what's the amount of time that has to pass by for all of us to forget? If they bring this up again in 10 years, we will remember this week. We'll remember how everyone reacted. And I don't think public sentiment, like, what's the charm offensive that the clubs can go on in order to enact something like this? I think this, what, like, ultimately, this has been thrown around for more than 20 years. And this was the one chance for the big clubs to do this. If they were going to do it, this was it. Once you announce something on letterhead and you put out a logo and you say, we're doing this, that's your one opportunity to do it. And the fact that they didn't have the mettle to, you know, pursue it, to go ahead with it, is kind of, I think, the ultimate sign that this can never happen. Now, you never say never, and I imagine maybe at some point they'll put together an investment package that's even double what they had already prepared with JP Morgan, and it's even more insurmountable. But I think the reaction and the way that it didn't work is what will be remembered, because the next time this comes up, people will say, oh, so like the Super League? And the Super League will have such a, if you, I imagine if you polled the Super League right now, it would poll at like 8% or something like that. And it would like only be like Real Madrid and Barca fans that would be for it. So like it would poll incredibly unpopularly. So the fact that this idea didn't happen, or at least we think won't happen, because, you know, the Real Madrid president says they have contracts, but we think won't happen, is kind of that stopping it from ever happening again. Now, and Mike, on the show, when we talked off air, has astutely pointed out, there will be a UEFA Super League in which, as the years go on, as the competition of the Champions League iterates, it will look more like what the big clubs laid out, because ultimately they do have an immense amount of power and can negotiate for quite a lot. But a breakaway Super League with no relegation, I don't think can happen.
So UEFA's president has said that the 12 teams that were involved in this are going to face some sort of punishment, but they haven't actually talked about what that is yet specifically. In your opinion, what should that punishment look like? And should it be different for the teams that pulled out sooner rather than later? I mean, you still have four teams that technically haven't pulled out at all.
I don't know. I really don't know what the punishment can be, because, you know, if you're UEFA, do you want to have a Champions League without any of these clubs? Do you ban them from the competition? I don't think so. I honestly don't know, because I think everyone is kind of at least invested in keeping these clubs around, right? If you're the Premier League, you can't run off the big six. They're such big drivers, right? So do you make it so punitive, or do you kind of, you know, pat them on the shoulder and go, hey, we know you did that, but, you know, we need you. Now it seems pretty clear you need us. Let's work together. Let's get beyond this. I don't know what the I mean, maybe the punishment is locking in the existing structure, right? Say, hey, if you want to do this again, and Jonathan Wilson made this point on Guardian Football Weekly, and I think he was bang on, which is like, if you want to do this again, we will codify a future set of punishments. But for the moment, let's kind of call this an episode and move on. But I don't know. I don't know what the desire is. I don't know what the desire is for the executives of these clubs that organize this to have them continue on in their positions. But I don't know. I don't even know what's even legally in bounds. I don't know what the best way to do it would be. So I'm kind of, I'll accept whatever the authorities come to in terms of what they believe to be the best punishment for this.
So I think the proposed punishment that I keep seeing that is most commonly thrown around as kind of like a slap on the wrist is a point deduction on a league-by-league basis. That feels to me like it could have some momentum in the sense that it's a short-term punishment. It affects some of these top teams potentially from reaching the top level of Europe. Like, if you deduct 15 points from Man City, that's not going to affect anything. They're still going to Champions League regardless. But for some of those other teams in there, like, that bumps them maybe from Champions League down to Europa, or from Europa out of it altogether, or in Arsenal's case, not even in it to begin with. In your mind, like, is that about probably where things will end up? I know that's kind of the same question I'm asking, but I guess I'm more curious how you think about point deductions as a punitive measure.
So the reason why I don't like it, even though, look, ultimately you're going to have to punish the clubs and it will have some deleterious effect on the coaches and the players. Deleterious. I like that.
Great word. Good word.
So it will have some deleterious effect on the players, but players didn't do this. Coaches didn't do this. Hell, even the sporting directors, the players, or the people who picked the players didn't do this. Why should they be punished, right? And so what would kind of be the way... Now, I actually think like from like a pure entertainment standpoint, the Big Six starting next year on minus 18 sounds kind of fun, right? All of a sudden, you're wearing an Everton hat right now. They got a chance to win the league.
Let's go. They've
got a chance. And like, how cool would it be? All right, well, you beat Crystal Palace on the opening day. You're up to minus 15 now. And like getting back to zero will be like a fun race to watch. And then it'll be like kind of giving the rest of the clubs a head start and seeing what they can do. Like, because some club is going to have, you know, five wins from seven to start the season. They're going to be, you know, 28 points clear of one of the Big Six clubs, and they're going to have to hold on to that league for the rest of the season. Like, from a purely entertainment standpoint, I actually think a points deduction would be pretty fun for next year. But getting back to the point of, like, not wanting to punish the coaches and the players, I actually think the thing that makes the most sense is transfer bans. Because if we're saying that you don't want to punish the players... Players aren't affected by a transfer ban. Hell, they might even get to pay, like, play more as a result of a transfer ban. It doesn't affect... I mean, it would affect the coaches because coaches want to bring new players in, but it's not like you lose current players, you lose the ability to compete. If anything, it might be a greater test of the coaches because you have to work with what you have, and that's all you have. So it punishes what ultimately is, I think, like, the most kind of difficult part of this breakaway Super League, which is... kind of exacerbating the financial might of these major institutions, right? So you already make a ludicrous amount of money. You already spend way more than every other club in the transfer market. What if we took away that advantage from you as a result of you trying to only further advance it? It's kind of like the thing that is most connected to the air quote sporting crime. So I actually, like, to me, the transfer ban is something that makes a good deal of sense here. But again, I don't really know what the best route to pursue is, like, from the standpoint of the stakeholders, right? If you're UEFA, if you're the Premier League, if you're Serie A, La Liga, whichever league is kind of issuing punishments here, what is the best way to go to kind of make sure that this doesn't happen again, or that there's, you know, some kind of retribution for what was a fairly serious act of rebellion from some of these clubs?
Is it fair to call what happened last week a soccer coup? Or an attempted soccer coup?
I mean, if it's not, it's the closest thing to it. Yeah, I mean, you're basically attempting to seize ownership of one of the aspects of the game that somebody else runs, right? It's like, well, UEFA run European competition. Well, now we're going to run European competition. So yeah, I mean, it is a seize of ownership of the game. So yeah, I mean... That's very strong language, right? I mean, given like what it's associated with. But yeah, I mean, it's ultimately clubs trying to seize power.
And can you indulge me here? I want to get self-involved, and I want you to tell me how to feel as a fan. So my two favorite soccer clubs, obviously Everton, I've got the hat on right now, and DC United in the MLS. I feel okay about Everton's prospects moving forward, but DC, I'm not entirely sure how to feel about that. One of my teams has not won a trophy since 2013, and I'm not even counting that because I didn't even know that DC United won that trophy until the day when I looked it up, so that doesn't exactly count. So, Witty, how are my soccer fandom prospects looking right now over the next few years? Do I have any hope of winning anything?
I quite like the direction that DC is going in under their new manager, Hernan Losada, and like he has this incredibly... enterprising, hectic style of play. He's trying to get fitness into the players, and clearly the DC United hierarchy did a fair bit of research because they kind of plucked him out of relative obscurity. So I also liked his match day one fit, like what he was wearing on the sidelines. Like,
yes,
wow,
he looked great.
That guy's rocking that jacket, those glasses. That was a look from DC United. I'll be honest, I've not had the chance to. I think I had them on my ESPN Plus quad box on opening day, so I was only kind of half paying attention to them. So Yeah, I think, like, in an MLS, there's always the route back. I actually, like, the build of their squad, like, the at least the starting players, I mean, Julian Gressel was a huge part of the MLS Cup winning side for Atlanta. You have Edison Flores, who should be, like, a really top-level creative player, Major League Soccer, given his record in Mexico. Ola Kamara is the center forward, is someone who scored goals in Major League Soccer for multiple clubs. So, I mean, you've got what would appear to be the base of a good team. It just kind of needed to be managed in a different way. So I think they're on the right track. Everton, I know that they've pulled off some pretty decent results. They beat Arsenal the other day.
Yep, first road win against them, I think, in at least 10 years.
I just find them, excuse me, so maddeningly inconsistent.
You're telling me, Woody.
I don't trust that they have a route to scoring goals match in, match out. I don't know what it is that they do. Like, I know that Carlo Ancelotti is a really tactically flexible manager. He comes up with game plans that are specific to matches, but there's no player real. And Richarlison's good. I just don't think he's, like, you can count on him every game to pull out a performance, or you can count on their system to produce chances. Like, they're a solid team, but ultimately, you don't go into any game thinking that they are definitely going to win it. And I just don't know, like, kind of what the future of that is, because they spent a ton of money on players. Like, and there ultimately is a ceiling on the kind of player they can attract, right? You're only, you know, they spent a lot of money on Richarlison from another Premier League club. Alex Iwobi, who was kind of a rotation player within Arsenal. Gylfi Sigurdsson, who was a rotation player within Spurs and then moved to a different club so he can kind of kick on to another level after moving from Swansea. Like, you're ultimately, like, capped at the quality of player that you can attract. So unless, like, I think actually Moise Keane was a fairly inspired signing, just didn't work out. You kind of have to go and, like, buy some lottery tickets to if you're really going to hit at a bigger level and try and find one of these young talents at a fairly high price and try and groom them to be one of the, like, a Gareth Bale for Spurs before he went off to Real Madrid. We've got a top-level Premier League player. You've got a window to keep him because he's going to want to go to a bigger club, like Erling Haaland kind of situation, like moving from Salzburg to Leipzig. You kind of want to jump in on those kinds of, and I know it's like, go find Erling Haaland. Yeah, that's easy. But yeah, I think you kind of want to get in on the ground floor on some top level prospects, because otherwise there's going to be a solid team. You don't know if they can beat anyone every week. And, you know, the ceiling on that is seventh, which is where they finish most seasons.
But you don't think Carlo Ancelotti, with his ability, as he's already shown, being able to bring in James on a free, being able to bring in Alan from, I believe, AC Milan or Inter Milan, one of those
Napoli,
two clubs. Napoli, thank you. Yeah. To be able to, and this is the footballing department side of things, but bringing in an Abdoulaye Doucouré, you know, bring in players like that. You have a Luka Dean on the back. You have a Ben Godfrey who looks like an absolute steal right now at center back. You don't think that maybe with that head coach that has some actual pedigree for the first time in the club's history in a while, like maybe he can up that recruitment and bring some folks in, especially with the new stadium on the way. You know, maybe,
but
there's a little bit of a sea change.
New stadiums are generally an impediment to that kind of spending progress, right? I mean, we've seen with Arsenal and with, like, Spurs, for instance. Spurs made the Champions League final while spending no money. Imagine if in that run they'd spend some money on players instead of, you know, worrying about the finances of the stadium. So I don't know if that necessarily, like, it's not a panacea in the near term. It's a panacea in the long term where you raise the level of your revenue. But I think in the COVID era as well, it's really hard to spend at the kind of level you're talking about where you're really kicking on from where you are now. Yeah, like I said, you're going to have to, like, James is a great example. It's a scratch-off ticket, right? Like,
yeah.
You're trying to rehab a player who has clearly hit the heights at the very biggest levels of European football and find consistent performances out of them that are probably a little above your station in terms of where you are as a club. But all those players you just mentioned are solid. Like, Luka Dean can be a French international. Like, that's pretty damn good for Everton to have a French international. But I just think there isn't enough in the aggregate to really reach Champions League level, which is what you're talking. You're talking about, you know, getting into the top four.
I honestly just want Europe, man. I just want Europe at this point. I want a chance at something.
You can get to Europe, I think, but I mean, I don't know. I'm not like listen. I'm privileged given the club that I support. You know, like Europa League for me is like Europa League. But yeah, I mean, for, you know, you can probably do that. But at the same time, I think if you really want to kick on and be at that top four level, like, there has to be a little bit in the change in the model, because I think you're getting a lot of players that are sevens, And I'm not sure that's enough to finish anything other than seventh.
So I want to bring this conversation full circle here. Earlier in this conversation when we started, you were talking about how you were making some noises when you heard certain words that really tickled your fancy. I suspect that the sounds that you were making were probably the sounds that I was making the first game that I watched Hamez play in an Everton jersey, because I had never seen someone handle the ball like that in an Everton shirt. I was like, oh my God.
That was the way at Spurs, right? I remember watching that and be like, wow. Like, Hamez, where has he been? Like, I know, like, it's hard for him to be that kind of player in Real Madrid or Bayern, because you're just like one of 11 in that team. And it's like really hard, I imagine, to fit in as one of 11 when you're James Rodriguez. But you see the moments of quality that are just like, oh my God, that 60-yard switch was perfectly into the stride of Luka Dean on an overlap. Holy hell.
I don't know how he does that. It's wizardry. It's absolute wizardry. I've never seen anything like it on our team.
Yeah, it's just a supreme level of quality that is the reason why he's reached the highest level of the game, why, you know, he was the star player of a World Cup in 2014. Like, it is an absurd level of quality with one foot. And also, like, he reached this he went a full game without registering a sprint. Like, it is the kind of the creativity of a number 10 that allows you to exist in the game that is almost entirely moved to pressing, while not being able to really press, without really being able to contribute. It's just another level of quality, and it's only available to a club like Everton if Real Madrid and Bayern Munich both say it's not worth their while. And it's probably because of that that defensive inability that James isn't in one of those teams. But look, that's Everton's gain. And it hasn't been that every week, I would imagine. I feel like early season James was extraordinary. We haven't really seen that recaptured in a while, but the moments you get to see it, like, that's why you watch football. Like, that's like that's the best part of watching the game, is players like James just doing their thing. And in some ways, you almost prefer them in an environment like Everton, where if you, like, a teammate of James can't go, hey, why'd you do that? Like, what, you're telling me, James Rodriguez, that I can't do that? Where it's like, I don't know, maybe Toni Kroos can. So, like there's just like that kind of level where you have a freedom to really express yourself and not be told by your coach, your teammates, that you're having like you're a ball hog, or that you're selfish, or that you're like, this is all about you. Yeah, it's all about me because I'm better than you.
I'm just trying to think. I can't think of anybody on the club. Maybe Luka Dean, maybe Richarlison on a good day.
That can maybe
tell him something. But like, Gylfi Sigurdsson strutting up to him, like, here's what you should have done. Like, no. You sit down, Iceland.
I don't think Andre Gomes has the standing to do that.
No, certainly not this year. He's been dreadful. Well, I apologize to the listeners for turning this into a soccer and Everton podcast here for the latter half, but I'm not going to apologize because I've loved every minute of it.
I'm not going to apologize.
Thank you. Witty, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on. I could do this all day, just banter back and forth. I don't know why people are so annoyed by you. I have found you delightful. You always have a place on this podcast. If ever you need another outlet, even though you have a billion to express yourself, you're always welcome on this fan podcast.
Yeah, I probably have too many outlets, to be honest. But I very much appreciate that. And I'm just immensely enjoying my time on the show. I'm alarmed at how many people have started following me on Twitter just so that they can see me retweet my own broadcasts in a bit of shameless self-promotion. But yeah, I mean, it's been an incredible ride being a part of the Dan Le Batard Show universe, and I have to thank Mike Ryan with like the utmost conviction, because he brought me in. He needed some help, but he could have found someone else to do it. He brought me in, and I'm immensely flattered that I was brought in, and I like kind of thank, you know, I'm not terribly religious, but kind of ulterior powers for allowing me to work on this show, because it's been one of the joys of my life.
Well, your passion for it shines
through. Sappy way to end the podcast.
No, honestly, like, if I wanted to go down this path, I could get very sappy right now. The fact that this conversation that we've just had on this podcast is the closest I've been to this show that means so much to my life. It is a part of my routine. And yeah. I could very well talk my way into the headspace of getting teary-eyed right now. I'd be crying crocodile tears if I could. But no, I mean, I think what's so cool is that the passion everyone on the show has for the show shines through. And it's the reason that someone like me doing this little janky fan podcast looks at that and is just like, that is the absolute dream. Like growing up, you know, I thought I wanted to make it to ESPN. And as I got older and more experienced and just developed as a person, moreover, it more became, I discovered your show and y'all's show and what you had going on. And it was like, no, like I thought I wanted to do the SportsCenter route, but no, it's that, like, to be back in that shipping container, like that is the dream. And so for you guys to be able to live that out, man, it's awesome. I'm speechless. See? You're getting me, Woody. You're getting me. I'm trying to talk myself into this, and I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to cry on this podcast. I'm not going to do it. So we're going to cut it there. Chris Winningham, you have a million things to plug, I'm sure. So let the people know where they can find you.
Listen to the Dan Le Batard Show with Stu Gatz wherever you get your podcasts.